Hey, there it is. Now we have to watch what we say.
Oh, wow.
now you're on record.
So Virginia, it's near 100 or so.
What has been until the last couple of days? The heat wave snapped Monday. We've been in the mid to high 80s since then.
Oh, okay.
We got 114 next day.
Oh, dear.
When?
That's awful.
Today.
Hi, this is Linda in North Carolina.
Hi, Linda.
Say your name again, please.
Linda Chapman.
Hi, Linda.
And this is Chuck in Detroit.
Hi, Chuck. You're one of our most faithful callers.
Yep.
So you're hearing the sound of our two moderators. I'm Sally. And who is this, please?
This is Mark Levin. Hi, Sally.
Hi. Hello, who's that?
McGregor Eddie.
Hi.
Hi.
Okay. And hopefully while everybody's getting on, if you're in front of your computer, please get on to pdacommunity.org and get into the issues and wars and occupations.
George Manos, New Hampshire.
Say your first name again, please.
Kenneth.
George.
Downing.
Thank you.
PDA Community, no dot?
PDACommunity.org.
Got it.
Okay. Anything else we need to do?
Yeah.
Well, then go to your issues and go to End Wars and Occupations. And if you scroll down on the right-hand side is the chat room. In case you have any questions during our speakers, you can ask them there, and then I can relay them. Or you can unmute and ask the question when we ask for questions. But this is another way to ask questions.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, this is Scott Taylor from McKinney, Texas.
Yeah.
Hey. First time caller, so I'm new to this.
Okay, welcome.
Good.
Oh,
you have a good, clear phone there.
Bruce in New York.
Hi.
Hey, Bruce.
Could I ask a question of McGregor Eddy? McGregor Eddy, are you connected to Jeju Island?
This is McGregor Eddy. I'm on the board of the Global Network Against Weapons and Nuclear Power in Space with Bruce Gagnon, and I am on the National Disarm Committee for the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom.
That's why I know you. Yes.
Yes.
My husband, my husband's mother was on that last organization.
Yes.
And I connect you in my mind with Jeju Island.
Yes.
Tokyo.
I'm also on the International Committee to Save Jeju Island. Yes.
Thanks.
Sure, thanks. Who are you?
I'm Sally Weiss. I'm one of the co-facilitators of this PDA call.
Okay.
The other voice that you'll be hearing a lot of is Virginia Holfair, who's the other co-coordinator.
Okay.
Hello, this is Lisa.
Hey, Lisa.
Hi, Alice from Bisbee here.
Hey, Alice.
Hi, Alice.
Hey.
Alice from Michigan.
Who was that from Michigan?
Kenneth Downing.
Say your first name, please.
Kenneth.
Yeah.
K-E-N-N-E-T-H.
Yes, thank you. Please announce your names.
Kenneth
Mel Hardy.
Downing.
And was there one more person?
Linda Hayes.
Linda Hayes. And where do you live, Linda?
Riverton, New Jersey.
There's somebody's
Lisa
dog.
Lisa, who's on the call? Is that Lisa Savage?
Yes, Lisa's on.
Okay.
someone just come on the call?
Mal Hardy from Washington, D.C.
Okay. Hi. We take it away.
All right. I think this is Virginia Hoffler, co-coordinator with Sally Weiss for End Wars and Occupations for PDA. I want to welcome everybody to the call. We have a jam-packed call, so we are going to get right to it. We're going to start with Sandy Davies, who's going to give us an update on what's going on in Iran. It's getting very scary over there. Sandy?
Yeah. Hi, Virginia. Hello, everybody. So, yeah, in fact, I'd like to talk about Iran and Syria briefly. Basically, in Iran, the nuclear scientists have a doomsday clock that seems to always be ticking closer to Armageddon. And when it comes to U.S. policy on Iran, there's a similar sort of doomsday clock, which seems to recently be ticking probably closer than ever to war with Iran. And, this is really based on severe misjudgment by the U.S. government. They believe that Iran can be pressured to give up the right that it has to enrich uranium under the Article 4 of the Nuclear Proliferation Treaty. The U.S. is increasingly isolated in its position. It has its NATO allies and on its side, but that's about as far as it goes. It has ramped up the sanctions against Iran, but it has been forced to offer to give exemptions to the sanctions to China, India, and a lot of other countries, amounting essentially to 80% of Iran's oil exports. So, in fact, the sanctions are really only applying to about 20% of Iran's exports. it's engaging in diplomacy, but from the very beginning, this diplomacy has been severely handicapped by what the Obama administration refers to as the dual-track approach. That is to say that at the same time as trying to negotiate, conduct very difficult negotiations with Iran based on 33 years now of severe mistrust and hostility between the two countries, that at the same time as trying to resolve those differences, it can be applying punitive sanctions and pressure against the Iranian government and the economy, essentially waging economic warfare against the country of Iran. Now, this is like so much of the Obama administration's policies, particularly foreign policies. This is a sort of political compromise between hawks and doves within the Obama administration. But the net effect of it is that the sanctions and the pressure completely undermine the diplomatic effort. And this is what we're really seeing going on. And of course, we have the pressure from AIPAC and Israel also, playing into this and adding to the power of the hawks within the administration. This really undermines the negotiations, which have now gone through three or four rounds in the last few months, but are continuing. I think that the U.S. military has concluded that there is no good military option. And the real danger here is that our two countries are just gradually moving closer and closer to war, even though, you know, the wise people in both countries, and particularly in our country, since that's, you know, this is our country, particularly in our country, understand that this is just absolutely disastrous. What the sanctions are doing is, in fact, speeding up the process by which more and more of the global oil industry is simply taking place, not in dollars and beyond U.S. control. Paul Wolfowitz said of the invasion of Iraq that it would make the United States the new OPEC. In fact, all of these policies are making the U.S. More and more marginalized in many, many areas of the world and in international relations. As the negotiations at the beginning of the Obama administration were demanding that Iran send some of its enriched uranium out of the country, and eventually Turkey and Brazil got Iran to agree to what had been the U.S. demand at the beginning. But once Turkey and Brazil got Iran to agree to that, the U.S. simply refused to take yes for an answer. So, you know, this is not, you know, war is not enough. If wiser heads can prevail here, there is absolutely no reason for the U.S. to be going to war with Iran, and yet all the missteps and political compromises of the Obama administration are gradually leading us in that direction. Briefly on Syria, Kofi Annan met with Bashar Assad the other day. Assad made a new commitment to the Annan peace plan, and Annan is now visiting Syrian allies, Iran and Iraq, presumably to, you know, to shore up pressure on Syria to comply with his plan. the question is whether the Free Syrian Army, so-called Free Syrian Army, the not-so-Free Syrian Army, will agree to this. Even as this plan was launched in April, a week before the day that the Annan plan went into effect, the United States and its so-called Friends of Syria group met to essentially reaffirm its support for the Syrian National Council and the Free Syrian Army. Neither the Syrian National Council is an exile group, and the Free Syrian Army is not related to the groups that began the protests against the Assad regime in June 2011. The legitimate, nonviolent, peaceful opponents of the Assad regime have formed a group at the very beginning. This is 13 different political parties and groups that formed what they call the National Coordinating Body for Democratic Change. They continually try to make clear to the world that they have nothing to do with the Free Syrian Army and they want nothing to do with the Free Syrian Army. Three basic principles of the NCB, the nonviolent protesters, are: number one, no foreign intervention; number two, no violence; and number three, no instigation involving the sectarian differences within Syrian society. And so really the bottom line is that in our conversations about all this, whether we're lobbying our members of Congress, whether we're just talking amongst ourselves or to friends and relatives, the two things that need our support are Kofi Annan and his peace plan and the National Coordinating Body for Democratic Change, who are the indigenous political opposition to the Assad regime inside Syria. And the two groups that do not deserve our support are the Syrian National Committee, the exile groups, and the Free Syrian Army. The U.S. government is supporting the FSA and the SNC. The FSA is being armed by Qatar and Saudi Arabia in a sort of competition for influence in the Arab world following the demise of Mubarak. And the role that the United States is playing in this crisis is inflammatory and very, very, very dangerous. And that's the message that I think we should be trying to get out.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Now, if you're not speaking, please hit star 6 to mute your phone. We're getting some background noise on the call.
Star 6. Star 6 if you're not talking. Virginia, could I interrupt a minute? We're having trouble at our house finding the chat room. Rich, can you tell us how to get on the chat room?
Sure.
It's not the setup.
Go to pdacommunity.org.
We're there.
Okay. There's next is issues.
Yes.
You can just do a / and issues. And then another / end wars and occupations with
right.
dashes between each one.
Right.
Yeah, you can also do it by picking off the menus, right?
And then where's the
about a quarter of the way down. Well, there's first on one
oh, there.
Side,
there.
On the
okay,
far
okay.
right side. Is the issues team's calls, leadership, our agenda, so you can find out what we're talking
yes.
about.
Right.
And right under that is the End Wars and Occupations chat room.
Good. And everybody can use that.
Do you have to sign into Facebook to use it?
Either Facebook or Twitter.
You have to.
Yeah, there are three options. You can use Facebook and Twitter and another one. I can't remember what the other one is.
The other one says guest.
Yes, maybe that'll
yep.
work.
And you can write it. You can participate as a guest.
I'm not sure what guest actually does, but I know you can use it. And that
Hi, will... this is Andrea. Guests
yeah, Andrea,
can fully
good.
Participate.
You
yeah.
can. Okay, good.
All
thank
right,
you.
I'm sorry to interrupt the discussion, but I think some people might want to ask questions by the chat room.
And also,
mm-hmm.
Rich posts a lot of links there, which are useful.
Yeah, so please, I'm sorry, Virginia, go ahead.
All right. So the next thing we're going to talk about is what are we doing in our own communities to get the message out that we do not want to go to war with Iran, and we do not want the United States to be an instigator in Syria. What are we doing in our own communities to get our anti-war message out? We're right now 4 months away from the election. If we don't tell our candidates and our congressmen right now what we want, they'll never listen. If they're not listening now, they'll never listen, because right now they're engaged in trying to get reelected or elected. You know, PDA has some of their own ideas, such as the brown bag vigils. The next one coming up is the 18th. There's also letter writing campaigns that you can just drop off letters at your congressman's office. I personally am a street action person. I really like the protests. You meet people that you would not meet in any other way if you're out on the street. And we wanted to have a general discussion about what worked for you. So if anybody has some great ideas for us, we are listening. We want to know what you're doing, what you think works in your own communities, because maybe one of us have not tried that before, and we'd like to get more ideas. I will say, I know Alice Hammers is on the phone, and I saw that that she lives in a small town in southeastern Arizona, and they actually had an entry in their 4th of July parade that was just fabulous. Alice, can you tell us a little bit about who helped design that entry?
Yes, just a group of us put together that float two years ago, I think. So we've entered as the Peace and Justice Contingent now for 3 years. We all the issues we do, we just slap on a million PDA signs, and we use humanitarian, because we're right on the border, we also bring up the border issues. Anything, but I have to say, there's, and certainly we're still on Get Out of Iraq and Afghanistan, nothing about Iran and Syria, you know. And one more comment on the side of that, and that is that I noticed even when we went to the Raul Grijalva event and Jim Hightower spoke, you know, he never mentioned the wars. Not once. He talked about Occupy and the banksters, and that's what seems to be on people's minds. And, you know, the wars that are going on overseas, the drone bombings, Iran, Syria, you know, wherever, we're Pakistan, wherever we're bombing, nothing. The militarization of both the southern and northern borders, nothing. So it's just interesting to me that that even seems off progressive radar.
Yeah,
good point,
you.
Alice. Mm-hmm. And that seems to me that's our job. We're the anti-war community on this call. So how do we shake that loose?
Anybody else have ideas they would like to share with us or tell us about recent actions in your own communities?
This is Lisa.
Lisa?
Well, this probably won't sound very pink, but I wanted to put in a plug for Letters to the Editor. It's the most read part of a newspaper. It's free. It would take most of us a rather short to send a letter to the editor, and I find that it reaches a lot more people than it might seem like, and you can really make an argument. It's hard, you know, I'm out there with my signs as much as anyone, but you can say a lot more in three paragraphs, and both Iran and Syria are rather complicated, and the American public doesn't have a lot of good background information, so I just want to put in a plug for Letters to the Editor.
Okay.
Alice again. I also think David Swanson made that through, I can't remember the name of his organization, but through David Swanson, you can get anti-war speakers. You know, I was thinking like Lieutenant Colonel Ann Wright would really be good, as I live in a military town, Sierra Vista with Fort Huachuca, that would be there are some, you know, military anti-war speakers. It would be good to have town halls with them.
David's organization is Roots Action, R-O-O-T-S, Action.
Right, and he sent me, I actually sent him, and he sent me a whole list of speakers, and there's some great speakers to be had, and maybe they could pull in some people who wouldn't otherwise be aware.
Right, because part of our job is definitely education, I believe. So we have to educate our communities on what's going on out there. We are preparing here in Phoenix to have a drone summit. Medea Benjamin will be in town at the end of July on her book tour, and we've scheduled an event where we're going to have a drone summit about, well, our governor here wants to allow them to test drones in Arizona. So we're putting the local spin on it, and we're going to try to educate people about what's going on and how we don't want more military. We have a lot of military spending here in Arizona, and they just want to keep it going, one right after the other. So we're going to be doing that. We do a lot of street actions here in Phoenix protests, although it's summer right now and it's very, very hot. So we try to do indoor things during the summer. And but part of that is we will en masse. When we hit a mark of, like we recently hit the mark of people dead in the Afghanistan war, we took to the light rail with this T-shirt that said, you know, 1,000 dead in Afghanistan, how many more? And just we just created conversations. People would ask us what we were talking about, what do we think should be done. And it's just a way to talk to people one-on-one about what's going on. And, gee, there's people that actually pay attention to this stuff. That's mostly the reaction we got, was that, oh, I forget about that stuff. The media doesn't have it out there all the time, so we have to make our own media. So do we have, I also, Sandy Davies is going to be at the Veterans for Peace conference coming up in Miami. Sandy, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, our PDA chapter in Miami is going to have a table at the Veterans for Peace conference here in Miami. I think that starts on August the 10th, like a four-day conference, Thursday to Sunday. Our local PDA chapter works a lot with VFP. We've got a good, we've marched with them in the Martin Luther King Day Parade every year for several years. And so we're really delighted that VFP is coming to Miami to have a national conference. And, you know, we've been raising money to pay the registration for a few more PDA folks to be there. And, you know, this should be a really, really great conference. The focus is actually on Latin America, since the conference is on Miami. But that's, of course, very relevant to everything else that we're talking about, because the U.S. Proxy wars in Central America in the 1980s very much created the model, what military officers have referred to as the disguised, quiet, media-free approach to war, that is now essentially being followed by the Obama administration. And that's part of what previous speaker referred to, and the fact that most people basically at this point have no idea what our government is actually doing with its military forces, especially the special forces in other countries around the world. So this should be a great conference, focusing on Latin America, but also on a lot of our other concerns.
Thanks, Sandy, and we look forward to hearing all about that on our next call, definitely. Do we have Mike Fox on
the
line?
Yep, Mike Fox is here.
Mike, take it away.
Salutations. Just want to thank everybody for being on the call and give you a brief update on what's cooking with a really exciting project we got going on. But first and foremost, I wanted to thank everybody on this call who helped with the Norman Solomon phone bank. For those who don't know, I was the guy that ran the nationwide phone bank. Sandy was on it. Sally was on it. Several other folks on this call were on it, did a great job. We broke a record for PDA. We did over 26,000 voter dials. That's nothing but an incredible effort, and I'm really proud of everybody who was involved in that. We unfortunately came up short by the slimmest of margins there in an election where over 150,000 ballots were cast. We lost by 172 votes. 172 votes out of 150,000 votes. And so, I mean, we can feel proud of that, most definitely, and also it's a teaching moment. We had 154 people who made calls, so literally, if everybody who made calls had done just four more calls each, less than 10 minutes, we would have Norman Solomon moving on to a November election right now. Instead, what we have is a centrist Democrat against a Republican in one of the most liberal districts in the entire country. So it was just a teaching moment for us where lots of people putting in just a little bit, can truly make a difference. But that being said, we've got a new campaign for peace to focus on. As Sandy was mentioning, we have the Veterans for Peace Conference, but that's really sort of a subset of the overarching campaign here. For those who have not seen, Dr. Quentin Young, a great single-payer healthcare advocate for the last 20 years, has joined the PDA board, and that's exciting for a couple of reasons. Number one, because he's one of the leading voices in the single-payer movement. But secondly, he brings with him, I'll be wholeheartedly candid, a 20-year long Rolodex of folks who have supported him in the past. And he has been kind enough to stand up, and he, with a group of fellow physicians, as well as some individuals at the national level, have all committed to raising $1,000 or more each within a program where we're trying to raise $50,000. And we want to have that $50,000 raised before Labor Day so that we can focus our those resources on a lot of different things, actually. Number one, we want to make sure that Dr. David Gill in Illinois gets elected. He's a good, solid peace candidate as well as a single-payer advocate. We likewise want to ensure we're continuing to support outreach to the peace community in general, like the Veterans for Peace Conference. And so what we'd like to sort of set as a goal here tonight, if at all possible, I'd like for us to be able to do at least as well as we did back in April. I don't know for those folks who weren't on the call in April. We had put our minds to it and said, okay, we're going to try to raise enough money to cover the website for a month. Our initial goal was $250, which we made in just a couple of days. We made it, a few folks donated the night of the ask, while we were on the call here, which everyone can do here as well. And if you aren't already on the chat page, I'm sure that was discussed before. If you're not quite sure how to donate, just please feel free, give me an email at mikefox@pdamerica.org, mikefox@pdamerica.org, and I'll just immediately email you a link directly to a donation page where you can literally make a donation while we're discussing these things tonight. Up to this point,
okay,
I've raised personally.
Let's stop a second and see if we can find the donate together.
Cool. You go ahead because I'm not in front of a computer right now. You describe to them where it's at.
Rich, can you help us? Or Andrea?
We're,
if we're on chat, Andrea? Where do we see donate?
Oh, the donate button. Okay. Let me...
It's below chat, isn't it?
No.
It used to be. I think Andrea's reordered things a little. Andrea, are you still on?
What donate link do you want? I'll put it right in the chat room. Which one do you
whatever
want, Mike?
Wants people to donate at.
Okay.
I wanted the VFP link, if anybody emails me, but if you want to put it right in there.
It's chat room, Mike. It's already there. I put it up along with a description of what it did.
Rocking.
So
beautiful.
People click on it.
If you go about two-thirds of the way down the End Wars and Occupation page, there's a section called Take Action, and the fifth item there is called Donate.
Beautiful.
Okay, but let's repeat Mike's email address. Give it again, Mike.
Yep. If anybody has any questions, Mike Fox, just like the animal, F-O-X, M-I-K-E-F-O-X, at pdamerica.org. That's Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. And
okay,
I'll be more than happy to send.
We're going to let this sleeping dog lie while we go on to something else, and we're going to trust that some people that can afford to do this donation will do this while the call's going on, if possible. And we're going to turn it over next to Rusty Eisenberg, who represents United for Peace and Justice. And
this is John Burkamp in Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi. So we're
Mike Gasola, South Bend, Elkhart, Indiana.
Hi. Good.
Okay,
Sally,
I'm on the
call.
Over
to Rusty Eisenberg because she and Gail Murphy are the peace movement relies on them to bring us news from Congress and when we need to know what Congress is doing. So I know Rusty's on the line, correct, Rusty? So
yes,
Rusty,
sure. Thanks.
We can give you a few minutes here.
Okay, and thanks for including me on the call, and I cannot talk as fast as Michael Fox. I know this is going to sound familiar to people, but the House of Representatives is about to vote now next week on the 2013 Defense Appropriations Bill. And some of you may think, didn't we just do that? No, we didn't. There was that was the authorization bill, but this is the appropriations bill, which totals $607.5 billion, and that includes $88.5 billion for Afghanistan. And it's a horrible bill for all of the usual reasons. The unusual reason is that because of the Budget Control Act, the size of this defense money is deliberately raised in part to make it more difficult for the discretionary domestic spending to happen. So whereas we always say in some vague way that the defense squeezes out domestic, now it's really not vague. Having this level of defense expenditure really means that there's much less money available to do other things, which is, you know, quite deliberate. It, you know, also opens the opportunity to for folks in the peace movement and domestic needs to work together. We're just finishing off now a sign-on letter about the Defense Appropriations Bill. Some of you may want to sign it. We're asking group people to identify with an organization, although we know that it's too quick to just do an endorsement. But you list your organization, so we're going to try to start doing that tomorrow very quickly. And the point of the letter is really to mobilize folks at the grassroots to call, fax, write letters to the editor, and really to highlight this particular bill. And there's so many horrible things happening, we all know what they are. But in the end, it's this defense bill that's absolutely critical. And we think it's very important that Congress people be held to account for how they stand on that. I should say, to be truthful, that not every national peace group is fully on board. Some of them are preferring to focus on amendments. We also think it's good to support amendments that move things in the right direction, so we don't disagree with that. However, the procedure is one that we won't even know what the amendments are until probably an hour beforehand. So the main thrust of our letter is really to say that this defense bill needs to be opposed very strongly, and PDA has really been, really a powerhouse in terms of doing that in the past. Again, there will be some amendments we know from Barbara Lee's office. We will definitely want to help with those amendments, you know, as we know them for sure. But basically, we want to get as many folks to focus on this for the next couple of days as possible. And it's very exhausting because it feels like this happens every year. It does, but in some ways it's actually worse this year than other years because of the domestic implications. So that's my quick summary. Sally, I know you have a crammed agenda, so if folks are interested in signing on or have questions, maybe, Sally, the best thing is for them to send a message to you, and then I'll answer it rather than to give all my phone numbers, et cetera, on the call.
Okay.
Sally, does that make sense? And does that
okay makes
with everybody?
Sense. And if Rich could put up my PDA email, which is end-war@pdamerica.org.
Right, and thanks
everybody. Don't
forget
about Mike Fox
at
the same PDA America.
Thanks to everyone from PDA, because you've really been incredible, you know, over the last couple of years. And I wish these things wouldn't keep coming back, but so far they're not listening to us. So thanks a lot, Sally, for having me.
Thank you, Rusty. And I'm working with Mike Hirsch on the PDA staff, and there will be an action alert will go out to all of us, at least by Thursday, possibly Friday, so we'll have an easy way to contact our Congress people that way.
Great, thanks.
We're Virginia, or do you want to introduce Lisa Savage, or do you want me to?
You go ahead. Look forward to hearing from Lisa.
Okay. Lisa Savage is the Code Pink coordinator for the state of Maine, and she coordinated with a person that's famous, at least up in our part of the world. I live in Massachusetts, so it's New England. A man named Bruce Gagnon, who's kind of like, I would say, the one of the grandfathers of the peace movement alive today. And the two of them, Lisa Savage, who's going to talk in a second, and Bruce Gagnon, started something called Bring Our War Dollars Home campaign. And I know in our city where my husband and I live, we had one of those campaigns, and it really enlivened the discussion. And so, we, you know, we're with a kind of a generator person here. Code Pink, as we know, is a rather brash and audacious group. And they've decided lately that Amnesty International is off track about the women in Afghanistan situation, and I think that's what Lisa's going to talk with us about.
Thank you, Sally. To backtrack a little bit, we'll get to the Amnesty International situation, but I'd like to start out at the NATO summit in May in Chicago. During that summit, the heads of state of NATO signed a statement that read, in part, in the 10 years of our partnership, the lives of Afghan men, women, and children have improved significantly in terms of security, education, health care, economic opportunity, and the assurance of rights and freedoms. There's more to be done, but we are resolved to work together to preserve the substantial progress we have made during the past decade. This statement galvanized many of us into action just because it's such an incredibly false narrative. And there are probably there is an argument to be made for some modest progress in some areas, and I'll speak to that. But to make the sweeping statement that in terms of security, the lives of all the people in Afghanistan, or economic opportunity, it's an absurd statement, I think, wouldn't be going calling it too strongly. So some of the responses to that have been that Colleen Rowley and Anne Wright co-wrote an article. And when they were in Chicago during the NATO summit, they saw these bus shelter ads that Amnesty International USA was running that showed women in burqas sort of holding a child by the hand, and then very large letters, NATO, keep the progress going. And these ads were advertising for a shadow summit that Amnesty held during the NATO summit, and which Colleen and Anne also attended. There was also an open letter to Presidents Obama and Karzai that was signed by Madeleine Albright and a host of other celebrity-type signers that AI organized. And Madeleine Albright was also one of the panelists at the Shadow Summit about progress for women. So Colleen and Anne wrote an article. Probably most of you have seen it by now. It was published a couple places, including Consortium News. And in that article, they belied the narrative that there's been a lot of progress for Afghan women, and also began focusing in on why would Amnesty International be helping NATO sell this false narrative. And they identified some changes in management at Amnesty that they thought were responsible, in particular the new executive. Suzanne Nassell, who had worked at the State Department during the time of Hillary Clinton and Richard Holbrooke and Madeleine Albright and Susan Rice and various others that have other roles now. So that was a sort of a catalyst for some recent activity that I organized. One of the things was a conference call a couple weeks ago inviting anyone in the peace community and also getting some subject matter experts, some Afghans who travel to Afghanistan frequently and could really speak knowledgeably. And we shared information on that call. I don't know if anyone else on this call did, but participated in a webinar by David Courtwright that WAND put on the subject specifically of progress for Afghan women. It was very well researched and very interesting. I just emailed Sally a link to it. They recorded recorded it and put it on YouTube, so if you missed it, you could watch it again and hear David explaining his slides. There were a lot of facts and statistics shared. Some of them seemed consistent with other things I was hearing, so I asked what the sources were, and Juan did send me a list of what David used as his sources, so I also shared that with Sally just now in an email in case she wants to share it more widely. The consensus of everyone, including David Courtwright and Faima Vorgetz, who's with the Afghan Women's Fund, the consensus on security is that security has been worse. It's deteriorated badly over the last 2 years, particularly for women, and that things are really quite bad in terms of safety. Women now hardly dare to leave the house without the burqa, not for religious reasons, for safety reasons, even in Kabul. And there are many schools have been built, but in many cases they're empty buildings because people don't feel safe enough to send their children to school. And then on many of the health aspects, it seems that the biggest progress has been, and it's a wonderful thing, training birth attendants and training midwives, because maternal mortality has been so high for so long. Afghanistan often is at the absolute bottom of the world, and that mostly because of unattended births. So there appears to have been some progress in that on that front. But in terms of international data on childhood mortality, life expectancy, Afghanistan remains just the lowest of the low. Currently, life expectancy for an Afghan woman average is 51 years, and that's after 10 years of NATO's wonderful, splendid progress for them. People are so poor that UNICEF says that 68% of Afghan children under five and under, are either suffering from wasting or stunting due to malnutrition. That's basically two-thirds of the little children aren't getting enough calories, enough to affect their development. So there's been some interest in sorting through what's known and what we can say for sure and which things are hard to tell in the chaotic security situation ongoing. Some of the other actions that have happened since the conference call are that I went to the Occupy National Gathering in Philadelphia before 4th of July, and I offered to give a workshop on this topic, Have Afghan Women Made Progress Under NATO? And it wasn't a huge turnout. I had about 35 people. It was 100 degrees in Franklin Plaza, and they were engaged and interested, and many of them were young people. And it struck me as we talked for an hour how little the younger people, the Occupy Wall Street demographic, really knows about Afghanistan. It has been this hidden war. They have a vague sense that it's going on. They've been told a lot of things about how we're over there for women's rights, but they don't really know many of the facts on the ground. And they were very appreciative of having a chance to learn some more about that. Another thing that has happened is that MADRE, the women's advocacy organization, invited Code Pink to partner with them to do some tweeting about the recent conference in Tokyo this past weekend, where the rich nations, the aid donors, come together, pledge how much money they're going to spend. I think it was through 2015, and the figure came out to be $16 billion. And our focus was very narrow. It was asking, are women at the table? Are there Afghan women involved in these negotiations and talks about, it's supposed to be development and security as the, sort of, heading under which this aid is being given, but 90% of it has been going to the build up the Afghan army and the Afghan police. And many of your subject matter experts, such as Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis' report on the Afghan police, really made it sound like they were more the problem than the solution, at least at this point in time. And again, we were trying to send tweets aimed at NATO and at the United Nations, kind of asking, like, how many women are there? The answer turned out to be that out of the Afghan delegation of 37 delegates to the Tokyo conference, two were women. So that's 5% or 5.5%. They were both associated with the national government. One was a member of Karzai's office, and the other was associated with the finance ministry in Afghanistan. So representation was also, there was some more representation through a lot of NGOs send people to these conferences, and they engage in side talks. We were told by the UN Committee for Women or Women's, whoever tweets as UN Women, that there were 15 women in that delegation. I still don't know exactly who those people were or how much influence they had. Were their voices really heard in these negotiations? So that's another thing that's happened recently that's brought a little bit more attention. I'm just going to share some quick bullet points from the conference call, and then I will return to the subject of the Amnesty International effort that Code Pink is involved with other people. One of the things that Fahima Vorgets of the Afghan Women's Fund said that really resonated with us is that women in Afghanistan are under attack from three directions. There's the violence that NATO visits on the civilian population. There's the violence that insurgents visit on the civilian population. And then there's the violence of their own government, including provincial officials, including warlords that have their own private militias. And many of them are in positions of authority, so there's no accountability when they when women are victims of violence at their hands. There are several laws on the books now protecting women's rights, but Fahima and the others agreed that it was in paper only. Really nothing was being done to enforce those rights. And also, yes, their constitution entitles women to 25% of the seats in parliament. And again, but do they really have a voice? Are they actually able to influence policy and laws? The consensus seemed to be no, they don't have very much influence. One of the things that the person, Mariam Rakib from an NGO called Afghanistan Sam Sortia, which runs tree nurseries and is engaged in reforestation and replanting the orchards, giving people tree seedlings that they can cultivate. Mariam spoke mostly about environmental effects, and some of the things that she shared she didn't have data on. There are really no studies that she's aware of on such things, but many, many of the women out in the countryside, she traveled in the southern part of Afghanistan and was able to speak to villagers and just common people who were very, very poor. They told her that miscarriages for birth have risen, cancer rates have risen, and some of the birth defects they were describing sounded very much like the kind of birth defects that are associated with Fallujah and places where depleted uranium has been used, like babies born so deformed that they aren't really recognizably human. One of the things that is a big health hazard there that continues because of the deforestation of Afghanistan from three decades of war, children gather little bits of plastic, like broken flip-flops and bits of packaging, and that's what their mothers used to cook with. So obviously this is a very, very toxic fuel and a bad health hazard. Access to clean water is a problem. The irrigation systems of Afghanistan have not been rebuilt over 10 years. And, in fact, I think we're all aware that if a man is seen digging by the side of the road, it's assumed that he's planting an IED, and he may very likely be drone bombed rather than someone checking if maybe he might be trying to reestablish the extensive irrigation system that existed before the Soviets attacked Afghanistan 30 years ago. Because Afghanistan was a very agricultural country and grew a lot of food that is exported before these 30 years of war. So that continues to be a factor that has gotten worse, not better, under NATO. I know we're on a very tight time frame, so I want to switch now to the amnesty issue. Colleen Rowley spoke on the call to that and basically said, I won't repeat what I've said, but they had done some research and found several publications by Suzanne Nassel before she joined Amnesty where she was laying out the smart power doctrine that the State Department has adopted and been operating under recently. And she has a great deal of power in the organization. She can hire and fire anyone. The board hires her, and then after that, all personnel decisions are hers. And recently, 2 weeks ago, she fired 20% of the staff, closed all the regional offices, let go the people that had been working on Guantanamo, and is bringing in some of her own people. Amnesty has some financial problems right now that don't have to do with her and that she was probably brought in to fix, but that's part of the context, I think. But at any rate, Code Pink's response with Colleen and with Anne was to make public these concerns, to compose a letter calling on Amnesty to ask for Nacelle to resign rather than going in the direction of doing the State Department and NATO's propaganda for them, and also to take a look at, you know, what their goals are. We also penned a press release, which was much milder, did not engage in any, didn't have any information about the personnel issues, sort of was more like a policy, focused on policy and disagreement with the direction we're heading. And so both those documents were shared, and people were invited to sign on. Many organizations did sign on to the letter. That letter will be hand-delivered by Ray Abelay of Code Pink this week, and then the press release will also go out. Amnesty has a book in New York, so there will be some, that's an opportunity for, makes a fuss about this apparent. I think many people were more appalled that they had Madeleine Albright on their panel than really, you know, the other things that went on. But I find a pattern, not just on the part of Amnesty International, but in the media and in some cases NGOs and other organizations, of continuing this narrative of why are we in Afghanistan? For women's rights. And they have improved. Well, there are more schools and probably more elementary education going on. There's some health gains. But in terms of security or rights or just general living conditions, things are still deplorably bad and have not improved. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lisa. So what can we do about this? That's really the question. Should the outrage really be about NATO trying to tell us that things are better for Afghan women, or what?
Well, I'm an educator, and I tend to be more interested in communicating to the public. My ideal audience is someone who's not paying a lot of attention, but if they did know the facts, would say, "Hey, that's not right." I don't personally think that NATO cares a bit what I think or say, or really, my government doesn't much anymore. I continue to hold those in power accountable, but I don't hold out much hope that they'll, you know, be swayed by my persuasion. So again, I return to, because it's complicated, I think educating ourselves so we sort of know, you know, you have to have a nuanced story about Afghanistan. You can't just simply say women's rights have progressed or, you know, nothing has gotten better for women. A few things have gotten better for women, but the substantial things have not, in fact, have gotten worse. And I think it's useful to be ready to talk to people, to offer workshops or offer to, you know, do calls or write letters, write op-eds. An op-ed is a good way, I think, to, again, Americans are very weary of the war in Afghanistan when they think of it at all, and this isn't the time for me to talk about bring our war dollars home, but they are aghast when they find out how much 1 minute the war costs. And so I think that, you know, getting in the narrative about, hey, and it didn't help women either, you know, how could really war women look this through? You're continuing to, you know, sort of work out for the public, you know, knowing to think through. Allowing Afghanistan to just continue as this horrible drain on our finances and this sort of festering sore at the center of the endless war on terror. So I think communicating with the public in whichever ways we feel. Speakers are great. I know that Anne Wright is very keen and calling to talk about this. So, invite them to speak in their community would be a great way to do it.
Okay. We have a question?
Yeah, this is Mark. I actually have another suggestion of something we could do. You know, the obviously a lot of folks are skeptical about what the civilian aid commitments will end up being that came out of Tokyo this week. But, you know, I think one thing to keep in mind is the United States doesn't control all that money. And there are, I think, legitimate donors within that group, some of whom, you know, like Japan and the Scandinavian countries, who have done a pretty good job overall of trying to keep aid really being humanitarian-based and that they don't have military in doing it. And I think the same thing within the U.S., you know, once we know what those commitments are, and they're not always easy to find out what they are, I just think if there's some energy we have left over from the larger message, which is what a joke it is to talk about delivering humanitarian aid in the midst of a war anyway, that we ought to at least try to see if there are ways we can hold those commitments that the U.S. has made, make sure they really happen, or at least make sure that if they don't happen, it's real clear about it. We had a conversation earlier today. It was really helpful for me to talk with you about this, Lisa. In general, it's been hard to connect the issue for many Americans that one of the reasons we have a terrible economy is that everything is drained by the war, and we wouldn't be fighting over things like healthcare so much if we didn't have all that money drained by the war. I think people also don't make the connections to what it does to people secondarily in terms of health. So I think the kind of publicity that that Code Pink and others drew to this issue over the last couple of weeks has really been terrific. And I just think that the money sometimes, the small gains that Lisa mentioned that have happened are very important, and they could be better, I think, if stay on top and push the issue more, because the money will be spent. And if we can see that it gets to Afghan NGOs, many of whom have gotten a lot stronger over the last 10 years, sometimes despite the war, not because of the war, that I think there still could be gains even before all the military stuff is worked out and whatever date it is finally that's out, there could be good things happening in the meantime. So thoughts I've had since this afternoon when we talked earlier.
Lisa, this is Sally. Would you just tell us what 1 minute of the war costs?
Could we have some people use their phones, please?
There were two of us talking at once.
Somebody needs a phone muted.
So, how much was 1 minute cost?
One minute of the war cost $230,000. A little bit more than that, but you could safely round to $230,000. So
I've never heard it said before, and so it's another way of – it's like another new talking point. I think
it's
Andrea's
a shocking amount of money that people have a hard time – but it largely has to do with the supply routes and paying the Taliban all that money to move all that fuel and food and the things that they need to conduct the war through a lot of rough territory. It's just – I don't think Americans really have any concept of how expensive that particular war is.
I'm pretty sure that already on our what we call the IoT or issue orienting page that you may be on right now, if you're on the chat room, you're on that page, and I believe that Andrea Miller, who's a national staff of PDA, has put some of the links that Lisa has talked about tonight there, and if they're not there now, they probably will be tomorrow. So I hope people on the call get used to looking at this End War and Occupation page of the PDA community website, because Virginia and Andrea and Mark and Sandy and Carl and I try very hard to keep putting fresh things there. And Lisa Savage, who's been talking the last 20 minutes, has given us quite a few things. I think we can probably post the webinar that she spoke of almost all the things that we will make a list of them, and they'll be there by, say, certainly this time tomorrow.
Okay, thanks everybody for being on the call. We need to keep the pressure on, get out there, educate the public. As Lisa said, it's a very complicated issue, so just even that little bit about what it costs for 1 minute of war, people are just astounded when they hear these things. So let's go out and educate our communities, speak up, and thank you all for being on the call. Sally and I and some of our kitchen cabinet will be on the phone a little bit longer if anybody wants to stay and give us any more pointers about what they do to excite their communities. Thank you so much.
Yes. If Sandy is still on the call, maybe he'll answer more questions about Iran and Syria, but maybe he had to sign off because he's just gotten back.
No, I'm still here.